And hello, this is Mitchell Plitnik, president of Rethinking Foreign Policy, and this is the Rethinking Foreign Policy podcast. It is just a few days before Election Day, and I'm hoping that if you're listening to this before the end of the day on November 3rd, you're aware that you need, at this point, I'm recording on October 30th, and by now, don't mail your ballot. It's too late. You can't count on it getting there in any kind of time. Make sure you bring it in to your board of electors or wherever you need to bring it into in your area. Or better still, go at this point to the polls and vote in person. Hopefully enough people have voted early to counter the efforts that Republicans have engaged in to increase lines at polling places and make it harder for you to vote. What's most important is that you get there and cast your vote, though. Okay, so moving right along. For those of you who don't know yet, I have started a semi-weekly newsletter. It's called Cutting Through, and it will keep you abreast of all of the latest work that I'm doing, that Rethinking Foreign Policy is doing. It will also have some original content in every newsletter, so there's something there besides just a list of articles. It's also going to have a new feature, which is recommended articles from other people, colleagues, or just good pieces of reading that that you should be keeping up with. So you can subscribe to the newsletter at Mitchell Plitnik, all one word, MitchellPlitnik, MitchellPlitnik.substack.com. And if you just go there, you'll see a sign up field. It will also give you the option of looking at a copy of the newsletter, one edition of the newsletter, so you can see if that's what you want. It's not going to overload your inbox, and it's a great way to keep up with what I'm doing and with other things that are going on in the world, and I'm trying to help people sort of, you know, just get through. The name of the newsletter, Cutting Through, it's trying to cut through the haze of just really simplistic reductionist and downright ignorant discourse that we have, mostly around foreign policy, but around all sorts of political issues here in the United States. So I think you'll find it really interesting. And then, like I said, it will not burden your inbox. So please go to MitchellPlitnik.substack.com and sign up for that newsletter. Also, just a reminder, in February, my first book, which I co-authored with Professor Mark Lamontel of Temple University, will be coming out. It's called Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. And I think it is going to be something very different from what people have generally consumed on the subject of Israel, Palestine, and the United States' interaction with that issue. I think people who are really steeped in this issue will find it to be a new and refreshing take on issues they know about. And people who are just looking into it for the first time, I think you'll find it very accessible and informative and give you a lot of background. So it'll be out in February of 2021. You can pre-order it now. If you're going to order it online when it comes out, or pre-order it, really do it at bookshop.org, so that way you support independent booksellers instead of getting everything from Amazon. So that's Except for Palestine by Mitchell Plitnik and Mark Lamont Hill. And as I said, it'll be out in February. And I'm very excited about it, and I think you will be too when you see it. Okay, so what's on the show today? Well, I'm really going to talk about two issues. I think there's plenty of stuff out there at this point about the election and really what more needs to be said. One of the biggest commentaries right now is that, there are so few undecided voters at this point, which is, normal for any election, but it's even at that, it seems to be an unusually low number now. And, of course, the choice is very stark between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, even for those of us like myself who consider that to be kind of an unfortunate choice, a choice of someone I really don't like in Biden and someone who's just a monster in Trump. So that's the choice I have to make. And I know many of you have to make it too. But as a result of it being, such a big, such a wide distinction between the two candidates, I think most people have already made up their minds. So, I'm really not going to talk much about the election. One of the things I will talk about, which is a little bit connected to the election, and that is the accusation from the Director of National Intelligence that Iran was spoofing emails, pretending to be the Proud Boys, and according to him, doing all this to make President Trump look bad. I think the first thought you have about that is he really doesn't need anyone's help. But so I'm going to get into that. And there's a lot of implications around that and what it means. And it really has not, given all the things that are going on right now, it hasn't gotten the attention it deserves. So I'm going to give it some in this episode. After that, I'm going to switch over to the United Kingdom and spend a little time talking about the suspension of former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn and how I see that. I think my take is a little bit different than what most people out there are debating around this. So I think that we will have, let me not get into it before I get into it. It'll be an interesting conversation. So stay tuned. I'm going to take a quick break and we'll be back and we'll talk about the DNI's accusation against Iran.
This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping up. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping up. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Look how I'm living up. Police be tripping now. Yeah, this is America. Guns in my area. I got the strap. I gotta carry 'em. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go into this. Yeah, yeah, this is gorilla. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go get the bag. Yeah, yeah, or I'ma get the pad. Yeah, yeah, I'm so cold like, yeah. Yeah, I'm so dull like, yeah. We gon' blow like, yeah.
Ooh, 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 ooh,
and welcome back to the Rethinking Foreign Policy podcast. So, last week, the Director of National Intelligence, John Ratcliffe, who is as shameless a political appointee and what can you say, Trump toady, as anyone you'll find in the executive branch right now. He called a hastily prepared press conference. And the purpose of this press conference was to announce that that the Iranians had apparently spoofed some emails claiming to be the Proud Boys that were threatening people that they needed to switch their party allegiance and vote for Donald Trump. Otherwise, the Proud Boys had their information and were going to make life hell for them, et cetera, et cetera. the scam, which was real, the scam itself was real and pretty ham-handed. It's hard to imagine anyone taking this very seriously, but the FBI investigated and did find that the emails did not come from the Proud Boys, which is not a surprise. The evidence tying it to Iran seems, as far as anyone can tell, pretty scant because they're not really showing it to us. But they are saying, both the FBI and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence are saying, that Iran was behind it. And it's a dubious conclusion, quite frankly. It doesn't make a lot of sense for Iran to do this, which doesn't necessarily mean that Iran didn't do it. But it does sort of raise the question of why they would do such a thing. It's, you know, according to Ratcliffe, he just decided to say, and there's literally zero intelligence to back this up, that Iran did it to harm Trump's chances. There's no evidence of that. And in fact, Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, did not say anything of the kind. So, and the reports this week are that Ratcliffe just decided on the spur of the moment at the press conference to say that Iran did this to hurt President Trump's chances. And there is in fact no intelligence to back this up. Not just that none was presented, there's no evidence of this at all. The entire thing smelled bad from the beginning. I think anybody who is steeped in foreign policy, national security, anyone who works in this field, follows it, right away knew that it looked odd. For one thing, the FBI seemed to be there for one reason and one reason only, and that was to make the statement that America's elections are still clean, that they are not, they have not been compromised. Christopher Wray's whole role at the press conference seemed to be to reassure people that none of this meant that that their votes were not going to count. And it leads one to suspect, again, not proof, but it leads one to suspect that the entire reason Wray agreed to be at that press conference was just to send that message out. He sort of traded the fact that it would give Ratcliffe statements more credibility if he was there for the opportunity to reassure people. You know, it's a judgment call. I don't think that was a smart decision, but, you know, it's a defensible one. You can at least make the argument. But what Ratcliffe did here was actually really important, and it actually is going to have an impact, despite the fact that this whole issue, the whole story, both of the spoofed emails and of the press conference, all of this is, you know, feels like just one more in a long, long line of episodes of fiascos from the Trump administration. And it hasn't gotten a ton of attention. Even the coverage it has, which has largely been critical from the mainstream media, there hasn't been a lot of it. There hasn't been a lot of attention paid. It just doesn't seem to have really made any waves. And that's a problem, because here's the thing about it. People did hear about it. People did hear about the press conference. It was a story. It was out there that there was this press conference that revealed that Iran was behind election interference. That's what people heard. They didn't hear a lot of the back and forth about the press conference and how suspicious it was. They didn't hear the fact that Ratcliffe went off script and embellished the facts at that press conference. They didn't hear any of that. What they heard was Iran was behind election interference. Now, the fact is, from what they presented, it really doesn't seem like Iran did much. You know, it's unclear that they were really behind those emails. If they were, it was a pathetic attempt to influence election on a very, very small scale. Not many people got those emails. It wasn't anything that was, you know, even had those emails been more convincing and realistic, and therefore effective, they didn't go to many voters. So it wouldn't have mattered, even if they convinced everyone, you know, many of the people who got it, it wasn't going to make any difference. It just wasn't that widespread. What this does, however, is create or add to, and it doesn't create it, but it adds to an atmosphere of demonization around Iran, which is the last thing we need. We've had it for 40 years, and Iran is the big boogaboo, certainly in the post-Cold War era. It's as a rival country, it's the greatest demon in propaganda speak. And it's useful in that regard. It is a theocratic state. Not a free society, although it's not nearly as closed as some others that we are very good friends with. It is, and you know, we have, you know, obviously decades of hostility between the two countries. And right now, we are as close to war with Iran as we've probably ever been over the past four decades. And that is not going to go away if Trump is defeated in this election. Joe Biden has made it clear that he wants to tone down the rhetoric. He wants to move us away from the brink of war, and he wants to move the United States back into the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. But he's also talking about how the need to be tough with Iran, you know, and the fact of the matter is that's probably not going to get it done when we were the ones who betrayed our commitments. We were the ones who gave our word and then broke it for no reason at all. We were the ones who abrogated an agreement that Iran was sticking to in good faith, as was admitted even by members of Donald Trump's own cabinet at the time. Jim Mattis was the most prominent, you know, then going and saying that we're going to dictate the terms about how we're going to come back into it with Iran, and expecting not only Iran, but our allies to accept that attitude, I think is misguided and probably counterproductive. But, you know, obviously still better than what Trump is doing, which is consistently playing with fire. If Iran had risen to some of the bait that Trump has put out there, we would already be at war. And you know, that's not going to be good for anyone. And anyone who thinks it is just mistaken. So that's one, you know, obvious problem, is that it adds to the inability of most Americans. It makes it harder for most Americans to look at the situation with Iran objectively in any, on any level. It just, you know, further prejudices people against Iran. That's one of the problems. Another problem is just this whole question of election interference in general. We have completely lost context of what this means. You know, back in, you know, and incidentally, it's crucial to understand that as much as Trump is responsible for that, Democrats have pretty close to an equal share of responsibility in this as well. In the wake of the 2016 election, you know, what we heard was the reason that Hillary Clinton lost was because of Russia. Now, in a race where she won the popular vote but lost the electoral vote because she lost several swing states by razor-thin margins, anything that was a factor in that is why she lost. That's, you know, why you can list literally, you know, I mean, I can just reel off a number of things off the top of my head, whether it's misogyny, whether it's, disgruntled Sanders voters, whether it's, the issue of Donna Brazile putting her thumb on the scale and giving Hillary a preview of the questions before a debate. I mean, you know, obviously the leaked DNC emails, there's plenty of things, you know, as, you know, we can talk about Jim Comey and his flip-flopping all over the place. We can talk about, you know, Trump's own, you know, banging the drums with the Hillary emails, the emails. We can go back to Benghazi. I mean, there's any one of those factors being absent probably would have been enough to just sway a handful of people to vote for Clinton. And, you know, she wouldn't have lost. And one of those factors, yes, was Russia's interference. But one of the problems that we are dealing with now is that the question of foreign interference has become so muddled. You know, it's one thing when we talk about, you know, Russian participation in perhaps hacking into emails and publicizing them. That is a problem. You know, this comes back, and, you know, discussing the question of Julian Assange and the attempts to extradite him and the international pressure that's been put on that is another podcast, one that I hope to do pretty soon, because I do think there's a lot to say about that. But when you're talking about something where you're, you know, breaking into email servers, pulling out the emails, and then publicizing those emails, you know, and you're only doing it to one side. It'd be one thing if you did it to Democrats and Republicans. You know, when you're only doing it to one side, obviously that is weighing the election in a way that's not legitimate, in a way that we should always, you know, try to prevent. It clearly tilts the scale to one side, and that's not what you want. When you're talking about Facebook ads, though, to my mind, that's a very, very different issue. And it's a question of, you know, it becomes a question of how our entire culture works and how, you know, the whole system of advertising works. Because, you know, when we're talking about advertising, what are we talking about? Whether it's, you know, an election campaign or trying to get you to buy a certain kind of soda, whatever it is, they're manipulating you into changing your mind about something or deciding something, whether it's just to buy their product or to vote their way. It's all the same thing. Right now, obviously, we're going to talk about, you know, in terms of an election, you know, who has the right to do that? Do other countries have the right to do that? And, you know, one of the best counters to that is, does Israel have the right to do that? Because they have, you know, obviously, and we see it all literally all the time in every election. The interests of Israel become election issues. They are, you know, promoted by various groups, which they have incidentally every right to do. I am not saying they can't do that. But how much of that can also be called Israeli, you know, official Israeli interference in the U.S. election? It's not always that easy to tell. Some of it is completely done by Americans, and, you know, some of it does have an imprimatur of the Israeli government's involvement, just as we do there. You know, all those posters all over Israel last year of Liga Acheret, of another league, a different league of their own, however you want to translate that, huge billboards of Trump and Netanyahu. I mean, so there's lots of, and part of the issue, I think the biggest part, the most important part, is not the question of whether Russia's buying a Facebook ad, but why we have a populace in this country that has been so dumbed down that, you know, they're incapable of seeing through that sort of thing. Because most of these ads are not that sophisticated. And that, by the way, is true of Russian ads, true of Trump ads, it's true of Biden ads. I mean, most of the stuff, if you really look at it with a critical eye, you can see exactly what they're doing. You may agree with it. You may support it. You may think, you may laugh at it. You may find it entertaining. But if you look at almost any political ad with a critical eye, you're going to see how they're slanting things in a certain way to convince you of something. And, you know, again, how much of that do we want to tolerate? And how much of it is acceptable? You know, but if we are training people from a young age in, you know, through our education system to recognize when that's happening, I think we would all find that Russian propaganda efforts on Facebook would be a lot less effective. Now, we could also get into the question of targeting those things. And that you know, obviously becomes a little bit different when you're when you get enough data about somebody to really be able to get into their head. Or at least, you know, on a collective level, when you know that, you know, it's Cambridge Analytica and they're isolating Black voters who are potential targets for being discouraged to vote because they have a profile of that. And sure, it's not going to work on whatever, 25-30% of those people, but that leaves a whole lot of people that it is going to work on. And that's going to be true of whatever group you target. These things are developed for a reason. They're developed, you know, often in either intelligence fields, military intelligence, national intelligence, or in marketing firms, you know, wherever. But they're developed by people who, you know, worked a long time to figure out how to get these things done and have decades and decades of research behind them to do it. I mean, some methods, obviously, like anything else, are more effective than others, but we know that it works, you know, to some degree. We know that done right, it's going to be effective. So, you know, and it's going to be a lot more effective on a populace that is not trained to think critically. And, you know, I mean, just look at, I mean, look at Donald Trump and, you know, listen to his supporters. These are people who will tell you up and down how they are thinking outside the box. They are thinking for themselves. They're not letting the fake news media tell them what to think. In fact, none of them, virtually, at least the ones you know that I've encountered personally, that I've seen on TV, virtually none have any critical thinking ability at all. Part of the trick of that is convincing people that they do have that ability. So, my point here is just to say that I think that, you know, whether it's Democrats with Russia, whether it's Trump with Iran and a whole long list of things, you know, when we're trying to talk about how elections are being monkeyed around with, I think we need to kind of step back and each one of us take a little bit of responsibility to say, you know, I need to look at this. I can't just, you know, say, oh, you know, MAGA, you know, or I can't just say blue no matter who. You have to actually look at your candidate and see what it is you're voting for, you know, and sometimes that's uncomfortable. Looking at Joe Biden for me is very uncomfortable. I really, you know, I to my mind, he is one of the least desirable among Democrats, most of whom I don't find desirable. And I feel a great need to be very realistic about who Joe Biden is and what sorts of policies I expect him to pursue. At the same time, you know, I also think it's necessary to understand the political climate, to understand that Joe Biden is a politician who is not particularly ideological and can therefore be pushed by, you know, by a democratic process and by activists. So that puts it on me and on you to make sure that Biden does the right thing. He can. And that's a big difference between him and Trump. You know, we need to understand these things as voters, and that's on us. Because the price of that is that the price we pay for not doing that is that John Ratcliffe goes out there and says Iran is behind this election manipulation, and that, you know, immediately clicks for us because, well, it's Iran, and we know Iran are bad guys. So, you know, and now we even see how much worse they are. They're trying to undermine our entire country is where that's where that goes. And you know, at this point, like, this is what I thought Ratcliffe was doing. But now that we're finding out that even within that press conference, he went off script to make these accusations and to specifically call them an attack on Donald Trump, just makes it even clearer. The evidence is not there. And let's also remember, when we're looking at this, you know, one of the reasons that he wanted to bring Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, up there, you know, Wray, you know, might have agreed partially because he knows that Trump, you know, it's been around for weeks now that Trump wants to fire him. You know, he decided to go up there to lend a certain credibility, which the FBI still has. Part of the reason the FBI has that is because so many people on the left look to the FBI as the source of the truth, again, over the Russia investigation. And I think those of us on the left need to stop and really think about that. The FBI has a very long history of being extremely hostile to people like us, in a very severe way. Now, you know, Christopher Wray is not J. Edgar Hoover, that's true. And the FBI has changed a little bit since the days of Hoover, but, you know, not it's still the same agency, and it still brings in the same people, and it still basically approaches things the same way. For those of you who maybe, you know, maybe are a little, you know, a little newer to the issue and to the history of the FBI, you know, I would very much recommend you look into the COINTELPRO program, counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO. Look that up. Read some of the books that have been written on it and some of the things that have come out about it. That's the FBI. So we need to stop looking to that agency as the one with credibility that's here to, you know, to protect us from people like Donald Trump. That is exactly the opposite. That history, the history of the FBI in its darkest days, was directed in many ways by J. Edgar Hoover and Roy Cohn. And Roy Cohn, as we know, is Trump's mentor. I mean, the point just comes back to, we need to counter this narrative. It is not at all clear that Iran did anything other than gather intelligence that is publicly available and think about how they might use it to influence American public opinion, which, you know, we should all agree they have every right to do, since we're killing their people with sanctions and doing so because we backed out of an agreement that Iran was sticking to in good faith. So if anyone has a right, not to interfere or rig our election, but to try and make their case to the American people to say, hey, you know, how about you put somebody in the White House who's not going to just, you know, willy-nilly kill our citizens? I think it would be Iran that has a right to that, which in no way implies that, you know, that regime is a bunch of innocent victims. That the Iranian theocracy is not brutal and destructive in its own way. That has nothing to do with it. What it does have, what we do have to acknowledge is that our elections, you know, are not just ours. You know, the entire world has a stake in it, and you know, it should not be a time for, you know, demonizing a foreign country that we're already doing so much harm to. Okay. Going to take a short break, and then I will be back to talk about what's going on right now in the United Kingdom. Stay tuned.
She's a pretty nice girl, but she doesn't have a lot to say. Imagine she's a pretty nice girl, but she changes from day to day. I wanna tell her that I love her a lot, but I gotta get a belly full of wine. Imagine she's a pretty nice girl, someday I'm gonna make her mine. Oh yeah, someday I'm gonna make her mine.
And we're back. Thanks for sticking around. Going to get into a topic that's probably going to get me into even more trouble, but that's okay. And that topic is Jeremy Corbyn, the former leader of the Labour Party in the UK, who this week was suspended from the Labour Party because when a report came out on anti-Semitism in the Labour Party that was mostly focused on the years of his leadership, he said he did not accept the findings of that of that party. That was one sentence in his statement. The rest of his statement, by the way, was a loud condemnation of anti-Semitism, a statement of complete zero tolerance for it. He did indeed say in there that he condemned it along with all forms of racism, which some people cynically twisted into some sort of All Lives Matter statement, which it was not. He was very specific about anti-Semitism here. Nonetheless, because he did not agree with the conclusion, all of the conclusions, he said, and he wasn't very specific about which conclusions he agreed or disagreed with, but since he did not just wholly accept it and do a full mea culpa, he was suspended from the Labour Party. I'm not going to, in this podcast, try and review the whole history of this. I've actually been researching and looking deeply into the question of Corbyn and the Labour Party and anti-Semitism and the accusations of it, and et cetera, for the past 4 years. And it's a sticky subject. It's subjective. A lot of it does not, as with many things, when you're trying to argue this is or is not motivated by other things, there's a lot of speculation that's inevitably involved here. And it's very, very hard to tease out what is really going on. But there's a few things that I feel at this point, pretty comfortable in saying. And I'm going to start with, with this point. Jeremy Corbyn, in my view, is an unskilled politician. Look, Jeremy Corbyn was a guy who was politically on the fringes of the Labour Party for a long, long time. And I don't think, that he ever expected to be in a position where he was leading the party. To be perfectly honest, I don't think he's very well suited for it. I happen to agree with him on most policy issues that I've seen him talk about. He is a socialist. He believes in very, very strong social safety net. He has always advocated social justice. He's certainly somebody who I think, I would not go so far as to call him anti-Zionist, but he's pretty supportive of the Palestinians and of the Palestinian cause. But he is not a political strategist. He just isn't. He does not think strategically very well. And I think you could see that in a number of ways during his time as Labour leader. He's great in talking about principles, but in terms of playing politics and trying to actually get things moving, that's not really his thing. And it was reflected in his wishy-washy response to Brexit. It was reflected here in the anti-Semitism issue, because I think perhaps the biggest thing he did wrong, and you can say this was because he's anti-Semitic himself, or you can say, as I would say, that it was simply because he's just not a very good politician, is that he was very slow to realize how significant the issue of anti-Semitism was within Labour, and even slower to respond to it in a proper manner. There are other things we can, there's a long list of incidents, many of which I think have been twisted out of proportion and out of reality. In some cases, I think circumstances were, when you look at some of the issues that have arisen for which Corbyn's been called anti-Semitic, I think when you take a little closer look at the incidents, they've been distorted. But the bottom line is Corbyn didn't handle it well. So I want to, start off with that. I think a lot of this is because Corbyn is just not a very good politician. So we start from there. We also, I think, as an American, I think it's really important for me, and this was one of the things that took me a while to really grasp when I started looking deeply into this, is that You know, when I started looking into it, I thought about anti-Semitism in the UK more or less as I do, as I think about it in the United States. I think it is a very real issue. I've encountered it myself many occasions. I've been physically assaulted because I'm Jewish on more than one occasion, as a matter of fact. You know, but it doesn't permeate my life in the same way that it does if I was Black. I'm a white man, and or, you know, again, the fact that I'm a man, it does not permeate, you know, when I talk to women and I hear their experiences, it's just not the same as the anti-Semitism I've encountered. It, you know, I'm also bisexual, and as a queer man, I've encountered things that are, it's not just encounters, it's not specific incidents, it's day-to-day living. It affects me, that has affected my life much more deeply than anti-Semitism has, both homophobia and biphobia. So I can say it from personal experience. I can say it from looking around at people of color and at women and at transgender people. I mean, I can go through, you know, and frankly, as Muslims. I also, you know, as a secular Jew who grew up an Orthodox Jew, I also know the difference of that experience. So, you know, I understand that, you know, I have a pretty, I think, good understanding of anti-Semitism in America and what that experience is like. And I thought it was pretty similar in the UK. But what I've come to find out is that actually in the UK, anti-Semitism is much more tightly woven into the fabric of the culture. It's just much more of a day-to-day thing than it is here. I'm not a sociologist, so and in any case, going into the reasons for that is not, you know, a good use of the limited amount of time I have right now. But that's one of the things that I needed to learn, and that I think makes a difference in how all of this plays out, because I think as a result of that, Jewish communities in the UK have reason to simply go at anti-Semitism and not worry about where it's, you know, what are the ramifications, what are the consequences, and maybe how are they perhaps being used for other ends. Because I think and the reason I bring this up is that I think there tends to be a confusion for those of us on the outside of the UK looking in, where we debate, is this about anti-Semitism, or is it about, you know, is it a cynical ploy to attack socialism in the UK and to make sure that Labour does not, you know, drift toward too far towards the left? And I think it's both. I think for the Jewish communities, and I think this is where I've run into problems with some of the criticisms, you know, because I've seen the Jewish communities accused of basically aligning themselves with the right to stamp out socialism. I honestly do not believe that's what any of these Jewish groups are doing, no matter how, you know, moderate centrist, even right wing, or at least conservative they might be. I don't think that's what they're doing. I think they are legitimately fighting anti-Semitism. And I think some people among them may realize that within Labour, forces within Labour, people, you know, sometimes refer to them as the Blairites forces within Labour have utilized the anti-Semitism crisis in the party to pull the party more to the right and to discredit the socialist wing of the party. And, you know, I am absolutely convinced that that's going on. And I think it's really important for Americans to recognize it, because the same thing is starting to happen here in attacks on Bernie Sanders, Jewish or not, in attacks on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, certainly Ilhan Omar, you know. We're going to see more of this because it's worked so well in the UK. I think you're going to see more Jewish resistance to it here than you do in England, because Jewish attitudes here towards anti-Semitism are different, because more people are aware in this country of how deeply entrenched it is on the right, and how on the left it needs to be dealt with and addressed, but that, you know, that the accusations of anti-Semitism on the left here are and those being compared because of stances on Israel to anti-Semitism on the right, how disingenuous that is. In labor, there was a real anti-Semitism problem that had nothing whatsoever to do with Israel policy. And it's very clear. I haven't read the entire 130-page report that the Equality and Human Rights Commission, something like that, came out with this week that led to Corbyn's suspension. But I've read the executive summary and I've gone through it enough to see that there's real, I mean, that a lot of this has absolutely nothing to do with Israel. And thankfully, they actually make it clear that they did not use the standard. They said they're aware of the International Holocaust Remembrance Association standard, IHRA standard, that has been so controversial. And that I just, you'll see in the New Arab sometime in the next day or two, I think should be, you'll see an article I wrote talking about that and how controversial that is and how poor a definition that is for legislation and for, you know, that sort of action. But they said they were aware of it, but they were not using it as a standard. And they actually showed where they did not, you know, use it as a standard. And I think they didn't, and that's good. The report seems like to show that there were real problems, and yeah, it shows that there were issues also with Corbyn's response. But this report actually does not entirely contradict one that came out earlier in 2020 that talked about how the entire crisis was essentially, you know, weaponized against Corbyn. That was widely discredited as untrue, but in very circular logic most of the time. It was based on the fact that no one believed it because it was unbelievable. No one believed it because of all these X, Y, and Z that we already know about Jeremy Corbyn, except that the report was saying that all of these things that you already know about Jeremy Corbyn were largely manufactured. So there was a lot of sort of circular reasoning there that led to the dismissal of this report back at the beginning of the year. And this new report does not actually, both of those reports can stand. You can argue that they don't, but both of them can. They are not mutually exclusive. So I think the important thing here is to understand that anti-Semitism in this case was indeed, as many people are saying, used to draw a red line as to how far left you can go and to put Jeremy Corbyn and the social swing of the Labour Party firmly on the wrong side of that red line. It was used that way. And the thing about it is that doesn't mean that the problems with anti-Semitism weren't real or that all of these things were just made up. They were not. They were very real issues that really need to be dealt with. But again, much like as I mentioned before, when I used the example of hacking emails of only one party in an election campaign, going at Labour's anti-Semitism, it's fine. I think that, you know, many of the recommendations that this report came out with, I think, are just fine. Do it, but do it in every party in the UK, and certainly do it in the Conservative Party, which has a much longer history of blatant anti-Semitism that's continuing to this day, and that people generally shrug off because they see it as Tories being Tories. And that is, not only is it dangerous, but it also means that you're opening up the very path that I think cynical forces within Labour have used to achieve their own political ends. Because if you only look to the Labour Party, the centrist or leftist or whatever part, however you want to characterize that, the relatively left compared to the Tory party, if you're only going to look at their anti-Semitism, then inevitably you're going to be pulling that party in a political direction more towards the Conservatives, because what the Conservatives are doing, you're saying, is perfectly acceptable. And yet somehow you're denigrating Labour for behavior that is at worst as bad as what you see in the Conservative Party. Now, one can argue that from a party that fancies itself progressive, that we should have higher standards or accept that, you know, I mean, that's sort of a nice ethical argument, but it's impractical. And it actually, and I would actually argue it's not an ethical argument, because you cannot have ethical standards that don't apply universally. And that's what we see here. You know, Corbyn objects to the conclusions of this report. I can understand why he does. I don't think the fact that he objects to them, I mean, there was certainly nothing anti-Semitic in his statement. I don't see how anyone could argue that. The fact that he simply does not accept the conclusion when the conclusion is pointing a finger at him, I think is, you know, suspending him for that, it seems absurd, but okay, I'll leave that to people in the UK to comment on British politics. But what is really important is that Jeremy Corbyn and the anti-Semitism scandal in Labour was essentially a test run. Can the right-wing reactionary forces, particularly pro-Israel forces, can they use either false accusations or real accusations? Because in many, you know, most of this was real, but the reality was taken out of context because they presented the anti-Semitism in Labour as being exclusive to Labour, as if it didn't exist outside of Labour in any of the other parties, and most importantly, the Tory party. That is a lie. That is dishonest. Even if every single incident of anti-Semitism that they looked at was absolutely real, the presenting it that way makes it dishonest and makes it ineffective. You can't fight anti-Semitism that way or any other racism. It has to be universal. And when you don't do that, you're opening yourself up to major manipulation, and that is exactly what's happened now. You know, you've seen, you're seeing with Keir Starmer, you know, a real march towards to the right and away from the socialist wing, which is, you know, almost being exiled from Labour at this point. And you know, that's a huge success. It's a huge win for reactionary forces. And it's going to happen here. It's already started. We're seeing false accusations of anti-Semitism or real incidents of anti-Semitism being taken out of the proper context, which is, you know, which is to understand that it is in the United States largely a right-wing phenomenon that occasionally pops up on the left as well in somewhat different form. But left-wing anti-Semitism is held up as being a particular scourge. Whereas right-wing casual anti-Semitism, now Nazism and Klansmen and you know, Jews will not replace us, sure. People generally don't accept that. But Donald Trump has gotten away with this like crazy. In many, many ways, and has inspired a lot of conservative anti-Semitism in ways that people on the whole, you know, just kind of shrug off. Whereas, you know, when Ilhan Omar talks about how a group like AIPAC wields enormous influence over foreign policy, and a disproportionate one, and one that has led to policies that have been very harmful, you know, she's called an anti-Semite, you know, despite the fact that, you know, Tom Friedman, who did get blasted for saying it, but still said, you know, that Congress has bought and paid for. He took it back, but nobody who works on this issue in Washington thought he was wrong. And nobody thought Ilhan Omar was wrong either. None of those people did. No one who actually is here and sees what's going on. And it has nothing to do that, you know, it has nothing to do with AIPAC being a Jewish group, because part of a great deal of that power in Washington comes from AIPAC's alliance with groups like Christians United for Israel. It's not a Jewish thing. It's much more complicated than that. You can find on my website, Rethinking Foreign Policy, an article I wrote years ago about why the pro-Israel lobby is what it is, and it has nothing to do with the Jewish community. In the sense that of some, you know, in the sense of some magical power that Jews have to control, it has to do with political activism, and it has in Congress, and it has to do with, you know, cold interests in Washington, and in the State Department and in the White House. Anyway, I digress. Getting back to and needing to wrap this up, to Corbyn and anti-Semitism in the UK. Corbyn is a progressive leader, and unfortunately, you know, by using anti-Semitism, progressives are scared away from him. And we cannot allow that to happen. That is not to say that progressives need to ignore or accept the weak responses and that Corbyn showed to anti-Semitism when he was leader, and some of the questionable decisions that Corbyn has made over his entire career. As I said, he's a bad politician, and he needs to be critiqued for those. And it needs to be, you know, the fact that he did not reach out at all to the Jewish community. The fact that, I mean, he did, I shouldn't say that, he did reach out, but the fact that he was unable to make the Jewish community feel like he really cared, that it was anything other than a political gesture, might have something to do with closed-mindedness, but it kind of felt like watching it from afar, but watching it, it did kind of feel like Corbyn didn't do a real good job of it. Now, these are things he needs, you know, that we need to criticize him for. He needs to be held to account for, sure. But this image of labor anti-Semitism as being some unique scourge in the UK is simply false. And it has been used to drag UK politics to the right, and that is not helpful. It hasn't been helpful for the UK in general. It's probably going to lead to this further splintering of the UK, which maybe not be a bad thing. But I think on the whole, that rightward drift in the UK is not going to benefit most people in England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland. So, and again, it's starting to happen here too. That same weaponization of anti-Semitism is happening here in the United States. And if we don't stand against it now, it will, like it did in the UK, become a force that we won't be able to stave off. And with that, I am going to wrap up this episode of the Rethinking Foreign Policy podcast. Once again, please subscribe to my newsletter, mitchellplitnick.substack.com. There'll be a new edition of that newsletter out just any day now, and it'll fill you in on quite a few pieces that I've published in past in recent days, and it'll keep you up to date with everything that I'm doing, and it will also provide you with a lot of useful information. So, with that, make sure one way or another your vote gets counted on November 3rd if you're in the U.S., and just try and hold on in these crazy days, and stay vigilant for how people might be trying to find alternative ways to hold on to power after the election. And most of all, stay healthy, wear a mask, take care. Someone to blame us. Someone to